All right, everyone, thank you for tuning in to another episode of Kineticast. Today we have Mark Bottenhorn, who's finished third at Worlds in High Rocks and podiumed multiple times in doubles. So, Mark, thank you for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm excited that we can finally make this happen. Excited to be here. Get started on this.
We've definitely been talking about getting this done for a little while, so it's good to have you in. And the almost finished out new booth, so that's helpful. So we have somewhere to actually sit down and record versus us being in my car.
I love this. This is super fancy in here. This is incredible. I'm jealous.
Wait till it's finished. We're going to have the lights off, and you're just going to only see the purple lights everywhere.
Oh, that's cool.
That's the future. That's so explain. So one thing I was just talking to you about, Dr. Brennan and I, we were talking about how you have finished top 10 multiple times through 2016 and 2020. Do you want to explain that, like in ultras?
Yeah, so in 20, like I identify predominantly as an ultra endurance athlete first and foremost, but then I do dabble in the hybrid stuff and get pretty competitive with it as well. But yeah, between 2016 and 2020, in various ultra marathon distances, I ran some of the fastest performances that year in North America. So as high as third and as low as like 40th.
Yeah, that's awesome, man.
Things, yeah.
I mean, we work with a lot of ultra runners. We work with a lot of like endurance athletes. So we understand how many athletes that means that you have to beat to do that. That's what's incredible about that, because think about how many people are competing in that. So it's really cool. So congrats on that one, first of all.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you. It's, you know, after 2020, I kind of shifted gears, but now I'm getting very hungry again to compete and get back out there. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I love it. So you've been kind of focused on soccer recently, correct?
Yeah, I mean, I've always played and loved soccer. I took a long hiatus from it, but I'm back playing at a fairly competitive level to where it's really fun and didn't have the pressure before of trying to play like at a really high level post-collegially.
Yeah.
And it's brought a lot of fun back into my life, but some setbacks too and some bad moments as well. So I'm kind of at a weird crossroads with it at the moment.
No, I think most athletes get there too. Like, there's always adversity that you have to face with different things, and where you're focusing and what sport and all that matters, and where you want to put it, like ultra versus high rocks versus soccer. Like, you have a lot of opportunity with the endurance level that you have, the athlete you are. So it's, what do you want to do with it, right? And then you have to think that high rocks will come with different things that can show up to affect the body, that then soccer is definitely going to have different ones, and then ultras will have different ones just from like terrain and what you're going through. So what's the hardest one? Like, if you had to say like full out, you're going 100%, which one's the hardest?
Oh, I think honestly, ultra marathoning is probably the hardest from a mental standpoint, at least. I think it's really tough to be like, you know, I ran North Country 50 mile, which is actually a 52 mile race. And so when you come through the first marathon loop, there's, you know, almost 4,000 feet of elevation gain in it. And you come through it, and then, you know, there's cowbells, everybody going crazy. And I'm leaving the race, and then I realize I have to do that again.
Yeah.
And it was like the most defeating feeling. And the fact that you can prepare for months, right? Like 12 to 16 weeks, or even more, up to 24 weeks for a specific race. And then it can all just go downhill on race day because you have a stomach issue or something. And it's not like you're racing 5Ks where the next week you can just pick one up. So it's like it's just a really high-stakes mental game, and it takes a lot of resilience, and it brings out a lot of, like, inner strength. So for me, that makes it feel like the toughest, but it's also, like, probably why I gravitated towards it the most, because, like, I'm obsessed with trying to be, like, the strongest that I can be.
I love that. Mentally. I mean, your progression from strength over the last couple of years has been amazing. Like, you can genuinely just look at you and see the difference in strength. The runner you are, like, gait pattern from just muscle mass composition. I mean, it's impressive to see for you to be able to travel that much with that. But I do talk about, like, the power and strength as one of the most important things. You have to be strong enough to maintain a pattern that long anyway.
Yeah, I think that strength training is helping me be more resilient late in ultra races where people normally break down.
Right.
And there's always a trade-off, right? Like, because you have to carry that weight over the distance, but like I feel that it affects me more in shorter distance races, probably 5K to marathon, than it does in ultra distance, because it kind of goes out the window and you just need to be strong and resilient to hold on. And so for that reason, I think that strength training is obviously a must for any runner, but for me, it gives me a little bit more free rein to really like focus on being truly strong, like weight class strong as well.
Yeah, and you're talking about the mental aspect of it. I think the funniest joke I always see is like, if you hear an ultra runner say they have fun, they're lying to you. Yeah. You know, because generally they get to a certain point where they're like, well, that wasn't fun.
Yeah, it's fun until it's not, right? That's like what we always say about easy running or ultra running. It's easy until it's not.
Yeah,
it's like you're jogging until all of a sudden you've just crashed.
Yeah, and you're fighting.
Yeah, so it's a weird type of fun. I don't know that I would call it fun.
Yeah.
And it's really weird because every ultra I do, I say, all right, I think I'm finally done. Like, I've done enough in my life and my career that I just think I can focus on other things and having fun. And then something like always pulls me back. So somewhere down there it's fun, but I just don't. It's hard to vocalize it.
Yeah. Well, then, so let's transition to soccer then. Yeah. So recently, some setbacks with soccer. We had some ankle issues, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. We were kind of a mid-table team all season, and playing at a pretty high level. It feels really good to be back and have this team like camaraderie and all this stuff that I really miss from doing team sports. I think that's the hard thing about like high rocks individual, right? That's why I really gravitate towards the doubles.
Yeah.
But it's the hard thing about ultra running too, because it's really just you and your mind for 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 12, 24 hours. And I love...
That's a tough place for me to be, man, for that long.
for anybody. Like, you learn a lot about yourself in those times. But at the same time, like, I'm really team-oriented, like, team-centric. And so to be alongside of a team, like, working towards common goals is really important for me. So, you know, like, it felt really good to get back into soccer. And we've been a mid-table team kind of all season, not performing as good as we could. You know, a lot of new players came into the squad, a lot of old players left, and it improved the squad overall, but we still weren't clicking altogether. It's to be expected. We were one win away from... We basically needed to win the last two games to get into the playoffs. And unfortunately, like, one of the teams that's in the way was the best team in the league.
Oh.
We'd already beat them earlier in the season, and I feel like I come alive against that team.
Yeah.
You know, and we played them again the last game of the season. It was win or go home, effectively. So ultimately... We were beating them at this point 3-1, and there was about 6 minutes left. It was like 84th, 85th minute of the game, and we were on a fast break, and one of our wingers played the ball across, and I play in the central midfield, like box-to-box role, and I found myself kind of at the penalty spot with the ball bouncing towards me, and so I went to just pop it over the keeper, and when I did it, the keeper slid through my plant leg, like late on the tackle, and you would know the word, but it rolled my ankle this way.
Yeah.
And
Inversion ankle sprain,
yeah. And just slid right through it. And immediately I knew something was really bad. I screamed just in pain, which is not typical of me. Soccer players have this sometimes like this reputation for like flopping around,
stigma, and
making more of it than it was. In this case, I'm sure people in the crowd thought that I was doing that, but it wasn't the case. I was hurting really bad, ended up ripping the sock off, the shoe off, and noticed that my ankle was already, huge. You know, bigger than a tennis ball. And I couldn't really see it because of where I was at. And, you know, people in the crowd were like, this doesn't look good. Like, I think this guy's leg is broken. Like, I had no idea. It looked like I had a broken leg. When I went to the hospital, like, almost immediately after, I was able to get an MRI really quickly, right at that time. And initially the doctor said, I think that's likely broken, for sure, but we'll see. And luckily it wasn't, but it was a really bad ankle sprain where they said likely incurred a lot of ligament damage.
Yeah.
And over the next few days, my leg just puffed up bigger and bigger. And, eventually, you know, I had to go right into some work travel the day after and didn't make it back for 5 days. But when I did, I saw Dr. Brennan, and that was kind of what got me on the road to recovery with that. And awesome. I incurred a setback coming back to soccer. I guess long story short, though, we won the game.
Good.
We won the game, which was like, for me, I was like, my season's done, but we won the game.
Yeah.
We had a delay, so the semifinal game was pushed a week back. My team won that without me, and then I was able to play 3 weeks later in the final, which is like a miracle.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to lie to you. I said I was 90%. I was probably about 40%.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But I poured everything I had into the game against the team that I got injured against.
The ultra mindset.
Yeah. Yeah, very much. And I said, I'm just going to get through this game, and then I'm going to take as much time off in the offseason as I need to. Like, I need to help my team win this championship against the team that I got injured against. And I want to point out that it wasn't anything malicious in that team. Like, it just – in that situation, it was just a bang-bang play.
Yeah.
They're rivals of ours, but I don't hold any grudge against that part. And we ended up winning the game 1-0 in a hard fought final, and brought home the first division championship in our club history. And added a bunch of great new players in this offseason, so things are really trending up. It was really positive, really good story. In the Tuesday kind of scrimmage training session after that, a guy who we were playing against re-injured the ankle.
A scrimmage?
Yeah, like we play on Tuesdays and Thursdays, but it's like people from our team on one Tuesday league and then people from our team on a Thursday league, just different people. And a few of us play on both, and we use those as training during the week because we don't practice traditionally because we're all adults with jobs and things like
yeah.
that. And I thought that I was good to go because I had played a full 90 minutes. I felt great. And then same kind of inversion, ankle sprain from contact again.
Yeah.
And it set me back, but this time only about 10 days. And now I feel like I'm close to 100% for real.
So that one was another contact one, correct?
Yeah, stepped on the ankle,
yeah,
rolled it under and slid through it exactly, and it blew up even faster than the first one, and I thought I've just undone everything that I've been working for the last month.
Yeah.
And it turns out it wasn't that bad of a setback, but man, it's swole.
The good thing is that you had done rehab ahead of time already, mm-hmm. but just sign of, like, still instability present, right? That's why yeah. it was so fast to go, and it went so far, and you're like, oh, yeah. man. And, like, and generally, I told you my history with my ankle breaks and everything that I've had. Mm-hmm. Like, once you start to feel it, you feel like, oh, that didn't go far enough. I'll be okay. You start to know how yeah. far that is. Now, let's try to prevent that, right? Let's try to build strength and strengthen it up so that doesn't happen. But the sad and hard part of soccer and basketball, too, is that there are times where you are going to have someone slide full power into the inside of your ankle joint mm-hmm. and just drive with everything they have to just push that ankle out mm-hmm. while that cleat is in the ground. And that combination is going to create inversion ankle sprains no matter how strong you get at a certain point.
Yeah.
I can argue basketball a little bit more about landing technique, where you're landing, where you're doing. And exhaustion is another one. Mm-hmm. So for ankles and ankle sprains, repetitive injuries, we have to think the amount of training and the amount of training on the legs and endurance is a big key. When I broke my ankles the most, I was playing 6 to 7 hours of basketball a day. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it was rough. Like I could eat whatever I wanted, and I weighed 180 pounds. You know, I'm at like 205 right now, but I could eat whatever I wanted, but I was just at my max capacity.
Yeah.
So I wasn't a great athlete at the time, and I'm not saying I was because of these facts, nutrition and all that. But when it's at the max capacity and you're playing on it, the chance for injury is higher, yeah. right? And so, like, the cool part is you were able to go in and help your team win and do that, but if you take a sliding tackle, like, it didn't matter that you just had re-injured it or you had injured it before, right? You were going to hurt that again. It's the same play.
Yeah, I almost argue because of the way he, like, in this situation, he stepped, like, full weight onto my shin. That just yeah. collapsed the ankle. I would almost argue that if it were with my right foot, like, the foot that wasn't injured, no. like, I would have probably sustained some type of injury, honestly.
That's what,
like,
I'm saying.
I don't, like, necessarily believe, like, you know, Dr. Brennan did a lot to get me back in a few yeah. time, and he said it's probably going to hurt, but I think you're good to go. And he yeah. was right. I don't think I came back too fast. I right. think it was just another freak accident or maybe slightly susceptible yes. situation, but I would have been injured either way from that.
That's what I'm talking about. So that's the injuries of soccer,
yeah.
right? Like, that's the stuff that, no, like, baseball, like, we'll have that around the plates and everything, but, yeah. Or bases, excuse me, but generally, you'll see that in soccer, predominantly for slide tackles and everything that's going on.
Football.
Football, yeah. Football's a lot of the, like, well, those are more illegal hits and stuff that yeah. we see generally, mm-hmm. which I know we've talked about a bit. So let's talk about Hyrox.
Yeah.
So let's transition.
Yeah.
So Hyrox, man, third at Worlds. Mm-hmm. What'd that feel like?
Yeah, first, I mean, I was with Bridget Brown, so she's, like, an elite female competitor, so we were in mixed doubles. Third at Worlds is incredible, you know, that was an incredible journey because I didn't think I was going to do any Hyrox stuff, and she kept texting me, and, you know, she lives in Florida. She would text me and just ask how my training is going, and I'd say, that's okay, but I wasn't training as much as I should. I was really struggling with anxiety, depression, all of these things leading up to it.
Yeah.
And we raced in Dallas, and I think we ran the 5th fastest time in America all time.
Wow.
And I was like, wow, I hadn't been training that much, you know. I kind of, like, lied a little bit about the amount of training that I was doing. And luckily, she was able to kind of carry us to some degree. But we knew that we had something there, and we did really well and qualified for Worlds. And so we went in Vegas ultimately, and we didn't have our best race. You know, my training ramped up. Everything was going really well. And then I went to Boston for work. And then I went from Boston to Detroit. On the way home from Detroit, I got a call that I had just been with my grandparents, and my grandfather had a stroke, and things weren't going great, so I had to go back. So unfortunately, he passed away, and I was really happy that I could be there by his side. You know, when it happened, I made it back. But ultimately, I ended up staying in Michigan between the first trip and the second trip, almost a month. I was gone for 30 days without being home before Vegas. And when I got back, it was straight to Vegas to race. So there was a lot emotionally that I was going through with overcoming some anxiety and depression. And then, you know,
a lot of mental load.
Yeah, dealing with the loss of my grandfather, who was, like, instrumental in my upbringing. And I'd never, frankly, dealt with, like, any kind of loss before, because my grandparents are, even now still, all the other ones are alive, healthy, happy, and I have a great relationship with them.
Yeah.
So that one hit me really hard. And I went in there with, like, a really heavy heart, and I think a lot of that was weighing on me. And but either way, you know, we underperformed based on what we could do, but we still landed on a podium in a United States sweep of the top four spots.
Awesome.
And it's a memory that I'll always have for the rest of my life of just high level competition. And it's made me hungry to do so much more.
Yeah, you said she was carrying you, man, but like, man, not a lot of people can keep up with her, you know what I mean? So like the fact that you're able to do all that, show up, have a top five time like that, and then come back, it attributes what type of athlete you are. So
yeah, and I think sometimes just transparently, like I think that I'm a great athlete, like genetically.
Yeah.
But I'm guilty of not always putting in the work not necessary for that. And it's hard when you're obviously, as you know, like when you're balancing owning a business, like working a corporate job on top of that, having a family with two young kids,
trying to be an athlete at the same time.
Yeah. You know, coaching 40 athletes, like,
gosh,
there are a million excuses that you can make, but frankly I just wasn't doing enough. And that made me really re-examine things going into this year, because it's like my biggest fear is living my life and looking back and saying I didn't capitalize on the potential that I had. And I think about how much regret I would have and how much disappointment I would have. So it made me realize like what I really want to do. So now I'm ready to go kind of full tilt on everything.
That's awesome, man. So what are you ready to do?
Well, it's hard. I mean, one of my close friends, Ashley, she's like pushing me to run New York Marathon. And so like, I kind of want to do that, but like, obviously, I really want to do a fall ultra, sure. Get really competitive in the ultra scene again. I would love to do 100K national championships next spring at Mad City, with a chance to, you know, try to compete and maybe make a US team. Who knows? Another, you know, high rock season in the fall. It's going to be really good. So, Victor and I are going to look I don't want to say to win worlds, but we're going to try to be competitive at worlds and see what we can do and see if we can land another podium. You know, Victor and I, we raced twice this year, came second and first. And then Karen and I raced twice this year and came second and first. So
I saw you on the Dallas one.
Yep. So out of four races, you know, to be on the podium each time, I think is positive, a step in the right direction.
Yeah.
And I'm just hungrier than ever to accomplish all those things. So a couple road races, bunch of trail races, and some high rock stuff. Selectively.
Yeah. So when you're competing in high rocks, what is the hardest part for you? Which station do you work on the most that you're trying to improve the most?
The hardest
yeah.
For me is the sled pull.
Sled?
I'm absolutely atrocious at the sled
pull. The pull?
Yeah, the pull. The push, I motor right through.
Yeah.
The pull, it's probably a technique issue. It's probably not a lack of strength, but...
It's not a lack of strength, no.
I squat more than I deadlift. So like there's something I'm not doing enough of, and it might be that I'm not deadlifting enough.
There it goes.
realistically it's something that I have to fix to be really competitive, because a lot of that falls on the shoulders of Victor or something like that. But you know, that's also the team dynamic, right?
Yeah.
So you're not gonna be the greatest at everything, but like I think the sled pull is the biggest challenge for me by far.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, everyone talks about the sled push pretty much as like the one generally, but then you occasionally hear like a different movement. Do you pretty much just grab those kettlebells and sprint for that farmer's carry?
Yeah.
I mean, just run through that, right?
Yeah. Like if it's a partner thing, like it's really easy. Like Victor will get halfway there, set him down, and then I'll just come to the back, pick him up, and we're running. So it's not
like a, yeah, that's what I'm saying. So like,
yeah.
That's interesting with the squat versus the deadlift as it comes to the push pull. Mm-hmm. Obviously like your, sled push is going to be more anterior. You're going to drive more with the anterior chain.
Yeah.
So you're probably just really strong there. And with the deadlift being a very posterior chain dominant, like think that's a lean back, like you're versus lean forward versus lean back. Right.
Yeah.
So it's directly like stabilizing posterior and getting patterned down. But I mean, pattern for you, it's not going to be so much about what's the most efficient way, because you get to see all the athletes do it and you can see which athletes do the best efficiency and you get to look at all that. Generally, it's what do you train to get better at that movement for yourself?
Yeah, no, I think I'm weak relatively on pulling movements, so that already puts me at a disadvantage. Like you said, I think all that is very accurate. Some of it is like my leverages too. Like I squat really well. So like it's just the way I'm built. I have short, stubby legs and a really long torso and short, stubby arms, which is not great for deadlifting probably either. At least in a competition sense.
I was gonna say like that. I'm a pretty good deadlifter and I'm very long limbed with a short torso.
Exactly.
It's the opposite.
Yeah. So like you have to battle that, but for the strength required for high rocks, like there's no excuse. So I'm gonna work through it and do more there. Yeah.
I mean, man, think, like, look at all the other areas, right? Like, that's the thing we talked about earlier. You talked about family. That's the number one right there. Two kids, man, I couldn't imagine. Like, I feel like I'm gonna miss my daughter. I don't get to see her enough. Like, I gotta get out of work, treat patients from 7:30 to, like, 6. I'm trying to work out at 4:30 in the morning just so I can get my workout in. Yeah. Get home, see my daughter for an hour and a half before bedtime, put her to bed, try to be a good husband for my wife. Mm-hmm. Nobody ask her if I'm a good husband or not. We don't want that feedback. But then it's like, okay, it's 9-10 o'clock at night. Am I going to like take 20 minutes for myself? Am I going to go straight to sleep because I need to recover and try to get my right sleep for the 4:30? What's the plan? And generally, it's my physical activity that makes that decision. If I am trying to compete in something or do something, it's sleep. Yeah. I don't get the specific alone time the same way.
Yeah.
And I think that is an area that you get from your ultras. Like I think you do get some alone time from that, and I don't mean that in a negative way in any way. No. I mean as a positive.
Yeah.
As like you get to compete, train, and you're doing this, and you're very good at it. Then you get to find that time. Especially with all the mental load that you've had recently and that you had to go through, man, like spending that time, and there's not a bad thing for you to work through some stuff through your brain.
No. Yeah. I think about like, I'm able to run, I run every day.
Yeah.
Right. So like I get time. It's kind of meditative in some ways when you're doing easy runs and things like that. So that's really helpful too. But you know, I'm really fortunate that like in my corporate job, like I work for New Balance, obviously. So in my corporate job, I work from home. Right. I have like a state-of-the-art gym in my garage that has anything you could need for HYROX. It's amazing, and it's been kind of like this like lifetime dream that's come true to be able to build that. And and so I'm able to step out in between meetings. You know, I'm able to see my daughters because I'm home.
That's cool.
So like I have it easier than some people. I have advantages, and I'm aware of that.
Oh, cool.
Know? So like I don't want to sit here and parade like everyone just needs to work harder. Right? It's all situational, and I understand that.
Yeah, but I mean, but the training, right? Like, that's what I'm saying. There's just, like, multiple aspects. Like, there's so much training that's involved for this. Like, there's a lot of running that's involved that you've got to be consistent and consistently running different ways. And, right, like, do you do, like, your hill work? Do you do sprint work? Speed work? Do you do everything?
Everything, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like,
I still train, like, way more, like, endurance athlete. But I mean, HYROX is an endurance sport largely anyway.
For sure.
So I train biased towards that. There are times where I focus more on like the HYROX specific movements as we get closer, like focus more on specificity, because like running wise, like if you're splitting with Victor and I splitting 350 per K or something, we're doing enough to run and qualify for world championships. No problem.
Yeah.
350 per K for me is, it's kind of a walk in the park, right? Yeah. So then I can focus on other areas that need work. But typically like my off season or like when I'm not 6 weeks out from the race is pretty much just a lot of running, a lot of skier, a lot of rowing, but mostly running.
A lot of people that will come in, they're like, hey, I'm going to try HYROX for the first time. What do you think I should do more of? I'm like, you need to run more.
Yeah.
the straight up, like, just run more.
Well, automatically, the run is at least half of the race.
Right.
Any way you look at it. If you're running, let's say, around like an hour, which is like an elite time, right, you need to split somewhere around 30 minutes in the run portion to make that happen. But people who are running an hour 20, like their run portion is really what's longer usually.
Yep.
So you could even argue that 60 or 70% of the race is aerobic specifically. And then even the rowing skier, when you factor that in, like that's aerobic. So it's really aerobic in nature.
The farmer's carry.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure. Burpees.
Wall balls. Burpee
jump. Yeah. Any of it. So, you know, there's a muscular endurance component, which also improves from running as well. So,
yeah
I would argue you need to run more.
Well, it's like if you're really going to train strength, you're looking at sled pull, you're looking at sled push. And what's the other strength ones that you'd hit?
Sled push.
Those are the primary strengths.
Yeah, right? I mean, there's walking lunges, but it's more muscular endurance.
That's endurance, yeah. Yeah, I don't. And the burpee broad jumps is going to be just like a muscular endurance and explosion.
Yeah, so pretty, you know, and when you're talking about like my worst event, it's definitely that. My best event is burpee broad jumps.
Really?
We're always number one for the whole day. You know, we, like, I just, it's my favorite one. Like, I don't know what it is. Like,
I'm weirdly good at that one too, man. I don't know what it is. Like, my wife and I, we did a couples one. We kind of do it for like our relationship thing. Like, we want to do workouts together and competitions together for us to build.
Yeah.
And so when we did that one, we got there kind of, she took the lunges for me. But when we got to that one, I was like, I did my first two. And I looked back and she was like looking at me like this. And people were looking at me. I was super springy for some reason. I think I've never been that far forward in my jump because I actually suck at getting anterior.
Yeah.
Like, you're good at getting anterior, right? Mm-hmm. But I think the burpee helped me. I think that the burpee pushed me into an anterior position because I was trying to explode out, right?
Yeah.
But, like, so I was weirdly good at that one. But, like, people struggle at that one,
That one destroys people, blows them up. And then it's another art form, too, to be able to do that. Like, if you can do it fast, that's great. It's going to blow up your quads. It's going to tax your aerobic system. But then you got to run right off of that.
Yes.
And I think that's where a lot of people really blow up. So to be able to mesh them both together really well, I think, is crucial.
That's what I think the individual is, like, so difficult, right? Because, like, you're doing it all. And you have to do it all efficiently and well. And you can't lag anywhere. You just got to be consistent flow throughout everything.
Yeah.
So if you start to, like, lose it in different areas, unless it immediately affects your time, you have no one to be like, hey, pick it up on this part right now so I'll be ready for my run.
Yeah. And I think the only cure for that is, like, just training time, like time under tension.
Yeah.
So that's part of the barrier for me, or barrier to entry. I think if we're talking purely on elite standards, like, to go sub 1 hour or something like that, like, the guys are putting in, it looks like to me, on average, 18 to 24 hours a week of training. Like, that's on par with, like, elite triathletes, right, which is, like, notorious for, like, long training weeks. So, I mean, if you're looking at a job where you work, let's just say 40 hours on the low end, because you got commutes and all these pulls, say 40 hours, another 20 hours of training, like, it's 60 hours right there, you got to sleep, like, what else do you do?
Dude.
So it becomes very hard if you're not, like, a dedicated professional athlete, and I think that's where doubles takes the edge off, where it can be really competitive, team-oriented, there's camaraderie to it, but also you can get away with training 8 or 10 hours and be really competitive in the sport if you're a good athlete.
If you're a good athlete, yeah. That's what I'm, and people, there, we have people that are trying to compete and trying to get better and better at High Rocks to do well in it, and, like, that's the thing. I'm like, just tell them, you got to run more, man. Anybody that I know that is very, very good at High Rocks, mainly thinking about you whenever I say it, is a great runner.
Yeah, I think that's the place where most people are going to take most time off, right? Because you see people who want to run a certain time, but then you see those runs start creeping up at 5 minutes per K. Mm-hmm. So, like, on average, that's 8 minute per mile pace, 5 minutes per K. So, like, if you want to get down to 4 minutes per K, 6:24 pace, you're right there taking 8 minutes off of your time.
Mm-hmm.
Just by improving as a runner, just mildly or moderately.
Yep.
So where else can you take that off? Like, if you row really, really well, what are you going to row for? Like, we get out of there sub 4, like, in, strap in, row.
Yeah.
Row 350 for 1,000 meters at 145 pace or 140 pace, 138 pace.
Yeah.
Get out, we're just under 4. How much faster is somebody going to go than that? Like, they're all the top times are just right within for all these events. Like, sled pulls second, sled. So it's the running that makes the difference. So you're right, yeah.
I think that what you're talking about, like, because that was when we're talking, when Dr. Brenner and I talk about it, because we were talking about doing doubles to see what we would get together and what our time would be.
Yeah.
And we talked about, it was like, well, Bo, you can row really well, and I can ski really well, and you're not a bad skier. Like, our times are usually the best just from what we do.
Yeah.
What is that truly going to do if we can't run a 6:20 or 6:24 pace?
Yeah, right. Like, so my argument is, like, you're probably going to smash Victor and I on the ski erg.
But right, I'm 6'3", and, like, and Brennan can, you know, squat 500 to 600 pounds. Like,
strongest guy in the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the thing is, you're going to still killing us on that means 30 seconds. Of that.
That's what I'm saying. Like, maybe 30 seconds.
Right.
Because your guys aren't bad at that, right? Like, you're good at that. You got to have a good speed. So even if like Brennan and I only trained Vince to beat you and Victor on events, y'all would smash us on the race.
Yeah, there's just not enough in the events to make up for it, even correct. If you do really, really well, because you have to be really good at everything, but running you have to be really good at. And so if you do, let's say, 20 seconds realistically, 15 seconds faster than us, which I don't see that often at the top right. level, if you guys were to do that, like probably some CrossFitters or you guys could come in and do it, but we've had that where CrossFit regionals athletes have come in
yep.
and done that, and they've been out 18 seconds faster than us.
Yep.
But then we've come in on that after that next run a minute faster than them already, so we're already 42 seconds in the positive, and there's no looking back from that point.
Exactly, and that's the coolest part about the sport for me, which I really like, because it's cool. I get to work with a lot of runners, and I get to work with a lot of CrossFitters. I get to work with all these different types of athletes, right? But the really interesting thing about HYROX is it forces you to maintain like functional capacity through movements while you're pushing the limit on how fast you can move.
Yeah.
And it's not like it's not an extreme distance that you're running. Like, this is a short distance. It's just shorter distance, we'll mm-hmm. say. But like, most people don't even run that distance, right? Like, what's the total? Is it like how many miles?
It's 8K, so it's 4.99 miles.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Was it like right at 5 miles?
5 miles, yeah.
Yeah, so it's right at 5 miles. Like, people that never even run 5 miles, they're like, how am I gonna win HYROX? Bro, you gotta run 20 miles.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, like, I think like a lot of elite HYROX athletes in general are running between 50 and sometimes 100K a week of running volume.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, you're looking at 30 to 60 miles depending on the person.
Yeah.
So like it's really hard to even do your best in the sport. Like, forget the elite stuff. Like, to mm-hmm. do your best in the sport, you have to be the best aerobic version of yourself.
And it's funny, because I'll go out there and I'll see like the people ready to compete and everything. People get hyped up, and I see some huge dudes, like biggest dudes I've seen in a long time, right?
Look like competitive bodybuilders.
Yeah.
Even CrossFit Games athletes.
Yeah. But that's what I'm saying, though, is like, but I'm watching, right? Like, that's who I see start to slow down on that run, sort of jog, got to take a walk break, stuff like that. That weight matters, right? You talked about that earlier. That's why I was saying that's the coolest thing about what you're doing, and I preach it to people. Like, you need to be able to run with muscle. One person that, when I was a rehab specialist, and I was very, like, new to rehab, and I was learning a lot of movement mechanics, and I was working with a lot of doctors and stuff, one of the patients we had was a former bodybuilder. He was a previous Marine that became a bodybuilder. And then he was a bodybuilder that transitioned out of bodybuilding, right? And he got into ultras. But whenever he would run his races, I think he did some Himalayan race or something like that. Mm-hmm. Whenever he would run his races, he would always tell me, he's like, Bo, the biggest problem is that no one is as strong as me. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I'm great at maintaining what I do for the longest period of time.
Yeah.
I can keep my leg, my hip, all this. And he's like, you guys help clean up stuff whenever this. But he's like, if I have some mechanic stuff, you guys are helping me with that. That's great. He said, that strength that I have is why. And this guy, like, straight up ran from San Antonio to Mexico. Mm-hmm. And he comes into our clinic with no appointment. And we're renting space out of some, like, medical doctor's office. It's like a family practice, right? So think, like, everyone's, like, sick and stuff in there. I don't know, no one's happy. The front desk isn't happy. No one's happy in here. This guy walks in with a huge sombrero on and opens the door to the offices where, like, you have to go, you know, where you have to, like, check in and wait, and they let you back in the back door?
Yeah.
Just walks right back in and yells, hola, like that. And everybody in the whole office staff stops. And that's when I knew that ultra runners were different.
Yeah.
I was like, that's the moment, man. Like, that's where I was taught.
Yeah, they're different, that's for sure. And this guy seems great, seems like a character. But I do believe as the race gets tougher, as the conditions get harder, whether it's weather, whether it's just the obstacles that you face in terms of elevation gain, technicality of the course,
yep.
any of those things, you're better suited by being more rigid, stronger, and more resilient. It's not like a track race. It's way different than that. And there are a lot more variables. And if you're more well-rounded, you're better equipped to handle those variables.
Yeah.
How you look at it. And again, when you're going further, like, I think the musculoskeletal system, like, protects you from breaking down. And if you're strength training the right way, you're going to be doing a lot of important things.
Well, that's like, we did your gait analysis here in the facility, and I remember, like, when we were talking about stuff, it was basically like, hey, what lifts should we be really focused on for improving running, right? Because for you, like, your mechanics are pretty good. Like, it's, I'm not going to look at you and be like, oh man, you got to change this. Like, you run well. You've looked at these things, you've practiced, you're a good runner. It's truly about finding these little things that we look at. And whenever we talk about, like, the strengths and different things to work on, that's the part where it's like, make that lift stronger so that when it's just your body weight, you can do it hundreds of thousands of times. Single leg exercises,
yeah.
Hundreds of thousands of times.
Yeah. Right. That's how I look at it. And like, and that's why I see like a lot of athletes, I start coaching and they come to me, they have like a general strength program they've been following from their previous running coach. And it's like, it's wild stuff. It's like, do like four sets of 20 to 25 reps of biceps curls and or like, and I'm just like, what is that doing? Like, and if you want to do like those like high rep movements and all that stuff, you're doing it by running anyway. So like, why not do the opposite? Like when you get in the weight room and better prepare yourself to do it with just your body weight by overloading, exactly, you know, on the shorter rep stuff. But
exactly. Well, that's like the you need a little bit of mass to be able to, but you can't get too big because that's that's the steady point. But by controlling that, it's basically a midfoot strike. So when you look at like the single leg stance on a midfoot strike, big toe should generally be in a good contact. You should have a good external rotation pattern. It shouldn't be a knee collapse. You shouldn't have the hip tilting. You shouldn't have the shift, right? But that's general for any single leg exercise you do in the gym too. So you, what you're doing is you're actually practicing a midfoot strike every time you do a single leg exercise and lift. Mm-hmm. So if you do those mechanically properly and you get stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger, well, all of a sudden, when I'm doing a single leg strike and running, it feels stronger and it feels easier.
You're doing it, you know, 20,000 times over the course of a run, right?
So, right.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I think that's just like a great point. Yeah, that's exactly it. That's what I was trying to say.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing though, man. Like that's what you're working on. Like, it was cool to see you do that and like see your adaptions. Like the soccer stuff, man, with the ankle. That's the sport specific stuff that I'm talking about. Like it sucks. Strengthen it as much as you can so it doesn't hurt as much later in the future. It doesn't go as far, right? That's all you can do.
Yeah.
That's the best you can do. Wear an ankle brace if you want to wear an ankle brace. KT tape to try to add support without restricting motion. I generally wear a KT tape for that reason, or rock tape, whatever brand you like.
Yeah.
But the thing is, like, that's sport specific. Whenever you're on a trail, like if you're not strong and you reach capacity and you step on a rock and that ankle's not ready to go, like Dr. Brendan cleared you, you're ready to go. Like you were good to run, right?
Yeah.
But if you're not and you step on that rock, boom, then all of a sudden it's like,
yeah, that could happen in general, you know, too, because some of it's just like freak accident stuff.
The like roots. I've heard about how roots like taking people down.
Yeah. So I've been fortunate. I've never had an overuse injury in my running career ever. And about 80%, studies show that 80% of endurance athletes suffer some type of overuse injury that makes them miss multiple days consecutively. I've never had that. I've had two kind of major injuries in since I've started running at a high level. One of them was an impact related injury on a trail 50K. We were running pretty fast, like in the low 6-minute pace on some really kind of undulated trails on the Ice Age Trail in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Coming over this hill and downhill, I was running and I hit a root dead on and it pushed my big toe like back through the metatarsal.
Ah!
So it broke my foot that way, actually.
Yeah.
So not just breaking the toe, but it broke the foot and broke two other toes. So that's what you're talking about there.
Like, I think we just talked about the importance of big toe contact with a midfoot strike.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was just unfortunate because like, you just can't see the trail because there are leaves on it and all this stuff. And sometimes it happens. And then the other time has been the soccer injury, which has impacted my running, but it was a soccer injury. And I think it's like the stuff that you guys have helped me with, the stuff that I was doing on my own before I knew you guys.
Yeah.
And it's those things that have kind of built a resilience along with varying my services. I think not enough runners like vary their services. Like you want to get on the track, you want to get on the trails, you want to get on grass, you want to get on, you know, dirt roads, whatever, cement as well.
Yep.
But by doing those and doing the things that those kind of things and the single leg exercises, stuff like that, like, I've been very resilient and been very fortunate outside of just impact injuries that were kind of freak accidents. So for me, like, it's a no-brainer, and we should keep doing it, you know?
Yeah. Well, and just so everyone knows, Mark's one of our Kinetic Center athletes, and we've done – Dr. Brennan usually works with him with, like, myofascial therapy, chiro, rehab, and, like, our functional movement screenings, our different screening processes, because what Mark's talking about, too, is that the functional movement patterns and the strength that he's doing are part of what he's training with. So Dr. Brennan's been handling that. We have done the gait analysis, which is an area that we've done. But it's been cool to see you progress. I'm excited to see where you're going in the future. And I see your work ethic and see the mind. Like, the brain is what's going to make you be that athlete anyway. If you don't have the brain for it, you're never going to be there.
No, I think it takes – we talked a lot about physical resilience. But if you don't have the mental resilience and you don't have the why, like why you're doing it, if you can't define that, like your mission statement, then it's going to – the training hours and everything is going to be hard. It's going to break you down. But like for me, my why is to like realize my potential and find the strongest version of myself every single day, and that goes into the athletic realm as well and to push my limits. So it makes it very easy on those days that I don't want to do it. And I think so often the mental aspect of it is not touched on enough.
For sure. I agree. Do you do anything for mental health or anything with that?
Yeah, I mean, I see a therapist. I do cognitive behavioral therapy. I think that's crucial, and I've always been a big advocate for therapy. I try to get into some meditation, but man, I'm not good at it. I'm just really not good at it, and I want to keep going. One of my athletes bought me this like meditation app as a gift. Like, he always gives me a gift every year, and I've been really trying to put some time into it, and I think it's helped. But really, I try to go through journaling. Just basically, I try to either do like some habit journaling or just kind of thought journaling at the end of the day. And then I try to do what I call an after action report, where I physically write out like the things that I did that day and what I could do better. I'm a perfectionist, so I try not to get too caught up on the self-help stuff, but yeah. Because if not, it just spirals out of control. But I do try to write in this instance, I did this and I would have done this better, because hindsight's 2020. And
yeah.
I just think it makes me better prepared for the future. And I try to bring that into my mental aspect as well.
No.
But I think those are the biggest things. And for me, a lot of times, like easy running, like I said, is really meditative. And it doesn't, and I, you know, people say like without running, I hear this all the time, like running is my therapy or something. I don't buy that. Like, I don't think that's a good, like, it might be a good outlet for you to de-stress, but like,
they're probably not running 100K when they say that, you know?
No.
Those guys are like, oh man, that sucked, bro. That was
yeah. And there are a lot of times that like trying to compete at the highest level, like, yeah,
you're pushing.
Training brings you stress, like
yeah.
physical stress, emotional stress, and the thought of doing it is stressful. So like,
yeah.
For me, I definitely need the outside source, like therapy. I try to read a lot, and I try to shut like electronics off when I'm really firing at a considerable time before bed, and that's very helpful.
Yeah. Well, and I'll say one more. So you're talking about like the meditation side. Mm-hmm. One thing that I've noticed a lot for athletes is the breathing work and the breath work. There's a big reason for that. And it's because different types of breath work, right? Like a lot of people look at Wim Hof, and because it's a stress focused version, but think like that's fight or flight, right? Like that's the point of Wim Hof. Like you're preparing for stress. You're preparing for that fight. Whenever you look at like Buteyko, Oxygen Advantage stuff, and you go through that side, it's more focused on like getting into the rest digest side. So parasympathetic versus sympathetic.
Okay.
So like if you think, if I sit there and I work on activating my parasympathetic, getting out of my fight or flight, and getting my rest digest, then I'm decreasing the amount of neural load as much as like, you're not going to have as much cortisol release. You're going to have so many different changes to that. And it actually changes blood flow to where you can switch blood flow to organs. You can switch blood flow. You can increase blood flow to your brain. And then you can take those methods, and without having to build the stressor like of zero oxygen and zero carbon dioxide, which is more Wim Hof, you can do more of increased carbon dioxide resistance. And then when you reach places where you have low oxygen and you have higher carbon dioxide in your blood, your brain doesn't hit the same response. It doesn't hit fight or flight in that situation. So like Patrick McKeown is someone that he's the leading guy for this. He wrote the book on Oxygen Advantage and all that. But he works with soccer teams. He works with rugby teams, and they work on this. They actually give breath work to do before you go into the game, what you should be doing at halftime. And generally this transitions, not the same breath work for that, but it transitions to what we teach CEOs to do before they answer the most important questions of their life. Like, what are you going to, if you have a multi-million dollar thing that you got to make this choice, this goes wrong, company goes down, this goes right, company triples, right? You got to make that choice. How do you go into it? You know, you're in a fight or flight response. This is a very stressful situation. So your brain is going sympathetic. If you have a way to increase your vagal activity, and you increase that vagal nerve and kind of control your heart rate a little bit, which is releasing acetylcholine and that'll help that. But if you have that, then all of a sudden you go from fight or flight response, let's just react, to rest, digest, and think. And then that rest, digest, and think can be a recovery meditative place as well.
Yeah, so that right there is what, like, that's what I need.
Okay.
In my life, like, right? Like, in my career, like, it's a lot of high-pressure stuff.
Yes.
You know, oversee a lot, a very large territory with a lot of money involved in the territory.
Right.
And then, yeah, I mean, just in general, like even with anxiety, right? Because I spend a lot of time in a heightened stress environment that I create for myself.
Yeah.
Like, that just, if you could send me some resources on that, that would be amazing.
We'll talk about it. I'll take this will be part of what we do since you and I do a lot of the gate running. We'll do this together and we'll go through it. I'll just take you through some processes. For an example, you talk strictly about anxiety. I have a patient, I'm obviously not going to say names, but she struggled with anxiety attacks and she's had them her whole life. And she's got kids and family and all that, but she got a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of people in this area that deal with a lot of anxiety because of stress of work. And here it's like work and grind until it's over, right? Like that's the mindset. That's like if you don't work and you don't make it, then you're a failure and all this stuff. Like that's the thought process behind all this for people.
Yeah. And when I moved here, like I come from really like humble beginnings, like in a really rough area just south of Detroit, and the household income there is like $22,000 a year.
Yeah.
And so to come where I live now and in the city that I live in, our median household income is like verging on $150,000, and everybody has luxury cars, and everybody's like really important. I mean, I was like,
but it's really important.
It's just so wild, and like it's like what I've always aspired to, and I'm happy that like I'm the least important for what it's worth. But like I'm happy that I like made it to this level, and
you got out.
Yeah, and I got this luxury car, the Mercedes, and all this stuff. And then I'm like, wow, I'm more stressed than I've ever been in my life.
You brought more
and, like,
stress.
Everybody around, and this whole thing is like a beehive, and that's really what capitalism is in general, right? You always have to be producing to have any kind of value in our world, and it's insane and overwhelming to think about. So yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, the thing is though, you get to have your business, and you get to have your stuff, and you get to create these things and do that, right? Yeah. The big thing that I see though is like with that stress level, this lady was having all these anxiety attacks. So like it was bad enough to where she'd have an anxiety attack while driving her family. She'd pull over the road, have to call her husband to come pick them up. Mm-hmm. So doing this breath work consistently, it doesn't mean that she didn't have the anxiety attack. It meant that when the anxiety attack happened, she was trained enough that she was able to activate her vagus nerve in the situation and be able to pull herself out of an anxiety attack for the first time in her life and drive her family home. And that was the coolest thing I heard, because that's someone gaining control of their brain and their physiological responses to what's going on mentally.
Yeah.
Which I thought was super cool.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing for people with anxiety is right, like just not having control, because you want to be controlled of everything when you're really anxious.
Yeah.
And to feel like you have some control back, like over that seems like it's an incredible thing, and it's weird because like you're never gonna prevent it, right? But now she's more equipped to be able to handle it when it happens.
Yep.
So that's
Because no matter what, something's always going to build up over time, but it doesn't happen as frequently because the stressors and everything aren't built up as much. So you're not stuck in that heightened state all the time. Yeah. And if you're stuck in fight or flight, we know there's a lot of cortisol release. We know this is all going on with some more inflammation, all the stuff that we all know about fight or flight and all the stuff. That's cortisol is a big topic at this point right now. Mm-hmm. But if you're not stuck in that all the time and you're slowly practicing it, bringing it down over time, when that anxiety attack does hit, well, you have a good control of bringing it down, and it's not going to happen as often because you're not just sitting on the max level, like capacity, right? Capacity for physical tissue as much as the mental health.
Yeah.
Like if you're sitting at capacity and something stressor and big happens, you're going to exceed capacity. What happens when you exceed capacity with physical tissue? Right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, gone.
Yeah.
So what happens when you exceed capacity on mental?
100%.
Gone. Yeah. Like you don't have control of that. And you know what? Like, we were talking before we started the podcast about like things that happen. Like you were talking about soccer, I was talking about basketball, and frustrating. But that I notice it, man. Like I play in a city league, and mine's really chill. Like we go out and like have fun, generally all that. But like when I have days where like, I'm working with people, and I've had to diagnose cancer. And when I say diagnose, I mean that I got it imaged, and then we have the exact images of it. So I'm not saying I'm diagnosing cancer in that situation, but I am saying that I know exactly what those tumors look like on X-ray. And whenever it says stage 4 cancer on a report that you get back from radiologist, and I have to tell a patient this, that I work with family and all that, that's tough. And I have multiple of people that like come in here, I can't do this and I can't work, and the people are stressed out, and that all builds up, and then I go play basketball.
Yeah.
You know how I play? Play awful. I'm like the worst player out there, man. Like I can't make, I'm a good shooter and I can't make a jump shot. You know what I mean? Wide open. There's people that haven't even played basketball before that I'm playing against, and I'm the one that's not doing it. And it's all because of what was going on during the day.
Yeah.
That's that mental health stuff, man. Like, I do, so what I try to do is in the morning when I'm done with my workout, I'll go into the sauna. Now I do it at two more extremes. I add extremes to it, especially with Texas summers and heat. So I'd rather be prepared for nasal breathing and lack of oxygen in 180 degrees. So when I get into 103 degrees and do nasal breathing and running, be all right. It'll feel like 80 degrees to me. I've been doing this in 180, right?
Yeah.
So I do it there, and I do my 4 to 6 minute like drill of like getting prepared for the day before I come into patients to set my mind, because I had pre-workout and all that. But it gets me set to work with my patients and be in the right mindset. And that helps me to start the day. I don't do it before basketball, and I feel like maybe I should do it before basketball.
Yeah, I mean, I had a similar situation happen to me yesterday. Like I said, we do Tuesday, Thursday kind of training games. And, you know, I had a terrible day with work stuff. I had, like, it seemed like everybody needed something from me. You know, it's nothing stressful like what you're talking about to that, like, life and death type stuff. But still, stressors.
That's not every day for me. Like, I'm not going to say that that's every day, yeah.
But, yeah, but it's just everyday stuff that I was dealing with, right? And it's relative to the person dealing with it, because stress is stress.
Right.
And, you know, and I'm playing against the guy who kind of re-injured me, and I know that I don't get along with I do not like him. Like, yeah. I will never like him. And he got mad about something during the game, and he kicked my leg out, like, intentionally.
Mm.
And because he knew that it was hurt. And he said, and his argument was like, well, if you don't think you're 100%, then you shouldn't be on the field. And because, like, it's fair game to me. But I'm like, it's such a dirty tactic. But either way, I blew up on the guy.
Yeah.
People were, like, holding back, restraining me, and I just tried to break through it. And he was, like, saying, you know, just wait for outside. Like, we'll do it outside. And I said, forget about outside. Like, I'm mad right now.
Yeah,
like,
he wants you to calm down before you do that. Yeah. You don't want to do that right now.
Right. So I got, and that's not who I am, though. Like, I try to be a peaceful, kind, compassionate, caring person when I can be. I'm not always perfect at it.
Right.
But I don't like to lose control like that. And I thought, man, so much of that was, some of it was fear of getting re-injured.
Yeah,
hurt,
for sure.
It hurt in that moment. But a lot of it was just the day that I let bleed into that.
Yeah.
And if I could find a way to get into a better space and not be in a kind of fight or flight. I mean, it was so bad that my stomach, you know, I was diarrhea, stuff like that. Like, I was that stressed. And so if I can find a way to do better with that, I think that's the missing link for me in all aspects of it.
Well, it sounds like you and I are about to start working on some of this breath work. The cool part is, do you wear different things to track HRV and other measurements like
my
that?
My Garmin does track HRV. I don't get too crazy into it. I used to use Whoop, but I don't.
Yeah. And I don't think the Garmin tracks the HRV the best, personally. They do it while you sleep. They're all generally while you sleep, which is okay, because that's a resting time when they generally measure it, like, at a rest, their heart rate and everything.
I do also. I just do a two-minute check first thing in the morning, too.
Okay.
And I use that more. If I'm going to use it for the trending, I use that, because the nighttime's weird, because it won't track for 4 hours sometimes if the watch goes like this. And so I'm not getting an accurate number.
That's my problem. So in my ring, when my ring moves, like, I wear the Oura ring and I have a Garmin, but I won't wear the Garmin at night. I wear the Oura ring at night.
Yeah.
But the Oura ring, generally, when it's not moving, it does a good job. Mm-hmm. But I've had, like, off data. But my point is, those data points are things you'll see changed through this work. Like, I use it that way because, think, if you're in a less stressed situation, what would happen to your HRV?
It goes up, right, theoretically?
Bingo.
Yeah.
Because with more stress, your heart's last three, but you're going a lot faster, right?
Yeah.
You're constantly going faster. And as soon as you're working on these things, activating vagus nerves, slowing heart rate, everything slows down.
I'd be interested to see how it impacts my resting heart rate. Like, that's probably the thing I most consistently track, because for me, I know that when my resting heart rate gets to certain points, mm-hmm. that I'm approaching a pretty high fitness level. When I'm unfit, kind of relatively to me, like, I'm kind of off season, mm-hmm. even though there really is no off, so whatever. But, like,
I was gonna ask you that one.
It's just around 39 to 40.
Yeah.
If I'm really stressed, I can get up to 41. You know, 38 to 41.
When you're sleeping?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But when I'm really fit, it's like sometimes 32, 33, 34.
Wow.
And, you know, I've gone to the cardiologist, like, doctor. Well, I've gone to the doctor before, and they're like, you need to see a cardiologist and all this stuff. And they're trying to go on, like, all these things that might be wrong. And I'm like, well, I run a lot. And they're like, well, that's the problem. Maybe you shouldn't run so much. I'm like, well, wait a minute.
So here's, yeah. So here's, let me talk about one more thing here. Sorry, before we cut this podcast off.
No, you're good.
So I have a guy who knows a cardiologist, and then he asked about HRV. And the cardiologist goes, oh, yeah, we don't care about that. And I started laughing because I was like, well, I mean, do you care about blood pressure, right? Well, yeah, I care about blood pressure. What happens to every person that walks into that office as soon as they see a white coat? I've just got elevated blood pressure. Every time you come in here, you have elevated blood pressure. And I'm like, no, because that's a fluctuating number, just like HRV. you don't take those off of singular data points. Mm-hmm. You take them off consistent, yes, fluctuating data points. And it shows you general health over time through stresses. Trends. It's trend data.
Yeah.
And that's what we do with movement patterns. We're looking at trend data for people when we do like functional care over time. We now see, oh, this is starting to show back up. This is this. We catch that before it's an injury. But with the HRV side, you should care about that because that's time between beats. That's showing you how fast the heart is moving generally at rest. And that's going to show you how much stress the heart is under and how much it's working.
Yeah.
So if you care about blood pressure, then you do care about HRV, like directly. And I was sitting there like, I couldn't believe that was said. But like, just because they don't track it or they don't do that, I think that someone's blood pressure over a month is better information than when they walk in and take it right there. There's almost no point in taking it in the office because generally everyone has elevated blood pressure when they walk in.
I have health anxiety so bad. Yep. So like for me, my blood pressure goes up to like 140, you know, but then when I take it normally and I take it in other settings or if it's like a sports medicine setting,
yep,
it's like 115. You know?
My wife dealt with it through pregnancy, and every time it's like, oh, you have high blood pressure. And I was like, she doesn't. she's coming in here. She's pregnant for the first time. She's freaking out a little bit. You know what I mean? Like, I'm freaking out more than my blood pressure is higher than hers is.
Yeah.
And but like, you have to think like it's a situation, isn't it? So what I did was I made sure we took it multiple times at home, and she did this. Like, I'm not gonna say I did it, but like she did her stuff and took it multiple times at home daily over a couple of weeks, and that's how we decided what her blood pressure was.
You average it?
Yeah, exactly. We're not trying to, and at different times, different days, look at like nutritional effects, like what happens like with too much sugars or whatever, right? Yeah. Caffeine, like you're not, alcohol.
Yeah.
Caffeine, alcohol. Those two things, if you drink a lot of caffeine or alcohol, your HRV won't go up.
Yeah.
You will not improve it.
Yeah.
Like I will have two beers, not feel much from two beers, and my HRV will drop from 100-something to 70.
Mm-hmm.
If I drink a little too much or I'm having fun or it's a celebration or whatever it is, if there's a good tequila around, I like tequila sometimes. Generally, I like it more than some. But if it's good, I go from 120 to 30 HRV.
30.
And consistent. I could, like, it's consistent. So it shows that like alcohol's direct effect. That's a direct effect on health of your heart and stress to your heart.
Mm-hmm.
So alcohol and athletes do not mix. Athletes should not be drinking alcohol. Now on the caffeine side, low levels of caffeine don't change much. But whenever we start to see the higher levels of caffeine, we see HRV changes.
Yeah.
So and caffeine is just more like a...
Some of that time of day that impacts it? Because I would notice if I would take caffeine after about 1 o'clock or something, my HRV would be lower, my sleep quality would be worse.
Yep.
But generally if I take it beforehand...
Yep.
You know, it didn't seem to affect it as much. I didn't know if that's part of it or if it was just taking it in general.
You're able to absorb it, get it out faster pretty much. Your body, like, readapts back. But it also matters, like, how much you're drinking, right? Because people are like, yeah, I just have a cup of coffee in the morning. I'm like, well, what size is the cup? you know, because I have people that have those big mugs. Mm-hmm. And they're the ice, I don't know what they're called, those igloo mugs. They fill that thing up with coffee so it stays hot.
Yeah.
Then the guy's like, I have one, but if no one drinks the pot of coffee, I'll drink the rest of it kind of a thing. And I'm like... That happens more times than they think happens.
Yeah.
And that overload of caffeine, that's what's messing up with, like, the renal glands and all the different things that, like, we have. Like, there's just things that in the body, hormone changes and all the releases. Not just about, like, the stress to the heart in that situation. When I stopped caffeine for a little bit just to see what would happen, the first 3 days, because I was drinking about a cup a day. If I didn't have my pre-workout at 4 a.m., mm-hmm. I'd still have a cup, like, of coffee.
Mm-hmm.
So when I cut it for a little while, the first 3 days, it took me till 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon to feel like I woke up. Like, I'm still, like, groggy and asleep. I did my breath work. I did everything. But, like, I didn't have caffeine, and I was groggy and asleep to 1, 2. And that's fast. Like, I've heard people, like, have more days than that.
Yeah.
But it was weird because I was talking to patients, like, yeah, I'm sorry. I mean, do that. And I felt bad about it. Like, I realized that it was, like, a chemical reaction response to it.
It's, you know, this is going to sound terrible.
Yeah.
But caffeine literally doesn't impact me anymore.
Yeah.
Like, it probably impacts my sleep quality.
Yeah.
And it impacts my anxiety and all these things. But I don't feel any mental or cognitive effects of caffeine anymore.
It's more like the taste good and the habit of having it?
Certainly, yeah, maybe. Yeah. I mean, yeah, like, the thing is, it's really weird because, like, I just, just stop drinking it, and like maybe I get a headache for a day, and then it's like normal.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's not really that the fear of that or anything. I think it's more just like situational. Like I just like pre-workout, to be honest with you.
Same.
But like it doesn't give me like the rush or excitement anymore. So it's like it's really weird.
What do you have like nootropics and everything in your pre-workout?
Yeah, yeah. I have a few different ones that I take. But now just recently I started working with Gnarly Nutrition.
Yeah.
And they're like way more endurance athlete, outdoor lifestyle focused.
Oh, cool.
And for that reason, they're not very heavy on caffeine and stuff like that. Like there are performance enhancing benefits of caffeine at fairly high doses.
Right.
But it's not a daily thing, I don't think.
Oh, that's a very situational thing, right? That's the Wim Hof stuff.
Right.
Very situational.
It's like race day performance stuff more than anything. But it's also a weird issue too, because then it can cause GI issues.
But that's the problem.
Yeah.
You can't go to fight or flight. Like, you prepare for stress and you get your body active to do that. We'll talk about all that later, right?
Yeah.
But the thing is, so there's a cold plunge. Dr. Brennan and I went into this cold plunge, and he got in there. It was the first time he did it. That man hopped out at 3 minutes, like, woo, I'm done. That was it. Yeah. Like, cold is not my thing, right? And I went in, and they're like, all right, Bo, you're going to prepare for it. And I was already doing my nasal breathing and my prep for it. And I got in, and at 3 minutes, I looked at Brennan and I said, I'm going to double your time, bro. And then at 6 minutes, I looked at him and said, I'm going to triple your time. And I got to 9 minutes, and I said, are we done, or should I just keep going? And he's like, what? And then, like, they're checking, like, the temperature and stuff. But it was the calmness. It was the – I'm not saying I was in digest mode. That's not what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I was not in fight or flight.
Well, yeah.
I was not running from that. It was very – it was cold. I was sitting in there for a long period of time. I wasn't shivering. I was sitting there in rest. And I was calm in that move, in that moment.
Yeah, and that's what I aspire to get to. For me, that's like what we talked about. So we're going to work on that, because that's the missing link for me.
You got
to
help me with that and like doing that before basketball then, okay? Deal. All right, thanks, Mark. Thanks for joining us. This was a good podcast, man. I enjoyed having you in here. Finally got the room set up. Finally got you in. Thanks for coming.
So happy to be here. Thanks for having me on. It was great.
Cool. And we'll get started on that Oxygen Advantage stuff soon.